Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Dawn French. If you like funny, then you like her. Double act partner, sitcom star, sketch show performer, writer, actress. It doesn't seem to matter how she makes us laugh. She just does. Her career started way back when dungarees were considered a legitimate fashion choice, and she's built her reputation on borderline surreal skits and glowingly warm characterisations. She was brought up in a forces family and had to move schools a lot. Making people laugh helped to make them her friends. Since then, it's made her a household name, and if she's not very careful indeed, she may be moments away from being given the queasy-making status of national treasure. So, does she ever feel overwhelmed by people's expectations? Well, she says, I tell myself that I'm the sort of person who can open a one-woman play in the West End, so I do. I tell myself I am the sort of person who writes a book, so I do. And I'm thinking of, you know, everybody you come into contact with, cabbies, shop assistants, me, we all want Dawn French to be funny for us. That must be a constant and daily pressure when you're just going about your business.
I guess it is, but on the other hand, it's the best fun you can have with your clothes on, and actually even with your clothes off, laughing, isn't it? And it's the glue that has bound my family, certainly the family I grew up in, and the family I've raised.
You said in your memoir, Dear Fatty, that as a child you were execrably polite and monstrously mindful of others. Is that still true of you?
Yes, although I think as I get older I am less tolerant, sadly. But I haven't got enough time anymore to put up with people's nonsense. But I'll give everyone a long leash.
So is your comedy the place where you're allowed to be the naughty girl? I mean, literally, and I've been in audiences at your stand-up and I've watched lots of your shows, and you hear people sort of screaming because they can't believe you've just said what you've said. And I can't say the sort of things on here because this is Radio 4, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's being badly behaved. It's everything that I was told in my childhood not to show off, not to be the attention seeker. There's just a moment in some of the work that I've done, especially with Jennifer, where that's exactly what we have to do. We're just misbehaving with each other. We're just doing whatever it takes to make that other woman laugh.
The very liberating thing to watch as a woman was to watch two women who had great physical self-confidence, who were not afraid to show you their slightly big bums, who actually were saying, this is all part of it and we like it.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were once described as running to fat, both of us. So we refer to each other as that very often. But the point was, these are the bodies we've got. These are the bodies that suit our comedy. And if it took being ugly to get a laugh out of Jennifer, I'd do it. I'd blow myself up if it will make her laugh.
Your list of eight for today, how difficult was it to compile the list?
It was agony, Kirsty. But I have chosen.
Tell us about your first then. What is it and why have you chosen it, Dawn?
I've chosen Bring Me Sunshine with Morecambe and Wise, because that's exactly what they did. And because of my profound and enduring love for Eric Morecambe, who made my entire family laugh so much, so often, and just brought proper sunshine into our lives.
Bring me sunshine in your smile, bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy.
Thank you, Eric Morecambe. Thank you.
And that was Morecambe and Wise and Bring Me Sunshine, of course. You wrote your memoir, Dawn French, back in 2008, Dear Fatty, it was called. And since then, you've written two novels. You find it easier to write prose than you did to write comedy? Because I always got the impression that it was something of a struggle for you to sit down and write comedy.
Yes, it was a struggle in as much as I'm easily distracted. If I'm writing with Jennifer, there's a lot of fun to be had. And it's a different kind of writing. And it's improvising and stomping about a lot. If I'm writing a book, it's me alone in a room with a desk and a dog. And who knew that I was going to find it such a joy? It's like having a new lover. I can't believe I've waited this long.
Does it come very easily to you then? Do you find it literally sort of flowing out of your fingertips?
Some moments I do. And some moments I have slightly spooky times with it where I write sentences that I didn't even know I knew those words. Without the aid of the thesaurus. I have not yet progressed to a computer. I write everything longhand.
Why is that then?
I don't know.
For anything?
No. Well, actually, I'm lying a bit because somebody did give me one of the little tablets, an iPad thing, and I know how to go on the Goggle and look things up if I have to. I like the paper. I like a pencil and with a rubber on top of it. I like the smell of the pencil. I do have an electric pencil sharpener. Don't go thinking that I'm not in this century, please.
We don't have time, I'm afraid, to cover every single part of your very wide-ranging career, but surely we must give some time to The Vicar of Dibley. It was much loved, of course, created especially for you by Richard Curtis. Here's the thing. I read that you actually wanted the part of Alice, who's the verger. Is that right?
I did, because when Richard showed me the part, or explained it to me, I thought, how on earth do you play a central character who's so blooming good? I thought, well, where are the flaws? Where is the monster in this woman? That's what I understand comedy to be. However, Alice was a very funny character from the off. But anyway, he wouldn't let me play it. And he did tease me by telling me the availability of other much better actors who could play it at the drop of a hat.
A lot of the comedy in that character came from her physical lack of skill. The most vivid image for me, of course, was the country lane scene where you step in a puddle and you
right up to my middle.
Yes, and beyond. Is it true you did a wee in that puddle?
I did. And you would, actually, if you'd gone in it, because it was slightly warm, which you can't resist. And also, it was a wee of slight delight and relief. Delight that that shot was over and done with, and relief that I hadn't broken my leg.
Some more music. Why have you chosen this one, Dawn French?
Well, this one is Alison Moyet, who is a very, very close friend of mine. She is a true confidant. She has heard everything I've had to say over the years, all the nonsense and everything else. And she's French. Her dad is French. And this is her singing in French. And I find it incredibly moving.
Ne me quitte pas. Il faut oublier. Tout peut s'oublier. Qui s'enfuit déjà. Oublier le temps. Les malentendus et le temps perdu à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuaient parfois à coup d'un pourquoi le cœur du bonheur.
That was your friend, Dawn French. That was Alison Moyet singing Ne me quitte pas.
Yeah.
Let's look back then. You were born on Anglesey. There is a wonderful picture of you and your brother and your mum and dad all looking very, very spick and span, meeting the Queen Mother.
Yes,
we did. What do you remember about that?
Although that wasn't in Anglesey, actually. Right. That was another posting in Leckenfield, RAF Leckenfield in Yorkshire. That was a very special day because we were chosen, I think, as a kind of safe option. A nice ordinary family, because when the royals visit any kind of military base, of course they go and see the officers, and we were the oiks down the other end. My mum cleaned our house for about 6 weeks. We had new shoes, little tartan skirt. We did curtsying practice. We bought new china, and for some reason I absolutely expected A, for her to arrive on a unicorn,
right,
and B, wearing a crown, please.
Not unreasonable.
Not unreasonable, exactly, but came in a sort of lilac hat. What was she thinking? So I was very disappointed. And then as she approached, no word of a lie, she smiled and she had black teeth.
Ooh.
Now, when you're four, people with black teeth are evil, witches or something. So, you know, no unicorn, no crown, black teeth. Please leave now. So I was terrified, didn't want her in our house, was hiding behind my dad's legs. In fact, I was clinging to my dad's leg like a randy terrier.
Did you get a ticking off afterwards?
No, well, I just was completely silent. But I was dumbstruck.
You say that you were the oiks down the other end of the base. Just what was your dad's position in the military?
He was in the RAF. He became a sergeant. He refused a commission. And I think that says a lot about him and about my family, actually. Very aware of class and how we don't really belong in that other class. I think we were a working class family, but my parents were so determined that we would lift ourselves out of the working class that they had all sorts of pretensions, really, well-meaning. But they sent us to public school, for instance, which the RAF paid a certain amount of. But my mum was delighted that that would be the case. And my mum decided to come to speech days with a special hat on with a buckle on the front and speak in a posh voice.
You did have a pony as well, didn't you?
I had a pony, but I didn't have the kind of pony that enters gymkhanas. I had a pony that had a disease called sweet itch, which meant that every spring, all of its mane and all of its tail fell out and it was just covered with scabs.
You say it wasn't a sort of gymkhana pony, but you did go in for a gymkhana.
I did try gymkhanas, but I wasn't suitable. The horse wasn't suitable. And I did have one moment when I was doing a race on this particular horse, and bear in mind, my dad had made the girth, I think out of an old tyre. And as we were bobbing along, I started to slip round and round and round till eventually I was riding the horse upside down. And that's not right.
And you were a child who was having a very middle-class education and from a working-class background. And when you were at school, did you feel like one of them or never quite?
Never quite. Never quite. Most of the girls that were there were from moneyed families. So if I went to their homes, they had beige carpet. That was something I'd never seen. And sinks in the corner of their bedrooms. I'd never seen the like, ever.
Giddying.
And they had ponies with hair.
Let's have some more music. We're on your third. Tell me about your third. Why have you chosen this?
This song is You've Got a Friend by James Taylor. And the reason I've chosen this is to celebrate my brother. My brother to this day cannot forgive me for claiming that I bought this album. This was the first album that came into our family home.
Right.
I think I paid the major amount for it, so therefore it should be mine.
I think
and it
right.
is in my keeping. It's from the album Mudside Slim, and we still argue about it now.
You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running. Oh yeah, baby, to see you again.
James Taylor, You've Got a Friend, from the album that you bought.
Yes, I bought it. Thank you, Gary.
And let your brother listen to.
Yes.
Can you remember your first moment on stage?
Rather than being on stage, being a performer inside the family really would have been my first taste of that. And the performers in my family were me and my dad. Everything in our family was done through jokes and humour. There was a lot of sarcasm, teasing. Very rarely would you get a spank, occasionally, if you'd really pushed it. But mostly my dad would say, it seems to be Dawn talking now the loudest. Everybody turn and look at Dawn because she's got something to say which is more important than everybody else at the moment. You know, it's that kind of sarcasm.
So there have been times in your career when you've mined the darker side of life, the darker characters, for the purpose of comedy. And you had two grandmothers who, I wonder sometimes if they're reference points for you. They were very, very different characters.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, they were jokingly referred to by me as Good Granny and Evil Granny. Good Granny was Marjorie French, who was tiny and always cooking cakes, taught ballroom dancing, was very loving and smelt lovely. And that was her. And then Evil Granny was rather sharp, a bit brusque, a bit of a rogue, certainly stole from me on occasion.
And what, properly stole?
Well, there was an incident with some pearls where I was looking to raise the money to go on a holiday and I didn't have quite enough. So my mum went up in the loft and brought down some pearls. She gave them to me as an exercise, really, to teach me to go into the pannier market and to sell them. So I went into the market, ready to barter, and on the way in, I met Lil, who said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I've got to sell these pearls." And she said, "What do you need? How much do you need?" Now, maybe I said £30 or something like that. And she went, "Right, leave it to me." And off she went, and she came back to the cafe, and she said, "Right, done." And she counted out the tenners, 10, 20, 30, 40. And I was delighted. And when I got home, my mum said, "OK, you've got £40. Who did you actually sell the pearls to in the end?" And I said, "Well, I met Lil." And she went, "Right. Did Lil sell them for you?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Right." We went, got in the car, round to Lil's. And she said, "Give her the rest of the money now." So Lil counted it out, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 100, something like 120 quid. But the way Lil saw it was, I benefited, she benefited, everyone wins. That's the kind of woman she was.
And did you find it hilarious or did you find it disturbing?
I was shocked.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, had my guard up around Lil. On the other hand, I had some of the best fun I've ever had with Lil.
Some more music then, Dawn French. We are on your fourth. What are you going to choose now?
This is Louis Prima. And it's Louis Prima with Keely Smith, actually. And I love Louis Prima. And this music reminds me of being married to Len and raising Billy. And we often played Louis Prima, especially on a Sunday, and danced around the house.
And just a gigolo, gigolo everywhere I go. Gigolo, gigolo, people know the part gigolo, I'm playing. Gigolo, gigolo, gigolo. Paid for every dance, gigolo, selling each romance. Gigolo, gigolo, oh, what they say. Gigolo, gigolo, gigolo. And there will come a day, and youth will pass away. What will they say about me? When the end comes, I know there's just a gigolo. Life goes on without me, cause I ain't got nobody. Kiss for me, this nobody. Kiss for me. I'm so sad and lonely. Sad and lonely, sad and lonely. Won't some sweet mama come take a chance with me?
Louis Prima and Keely Smith, oh. And just a gigolo. I ain't got nobody. You enjoy
palpable
that,
joy, isn't it?
I want to take you back to the Central School of Speech and Drama, which was famously where you met your comedy partner, Jennifer Saunders. But I want to ask you specifically, you were 19. What do you remember about the first few days when you arrived there?
Well, my dad had just died, sadly committed suicide, about 2 weeks, I think, before I arrived at the college. And I was late for the start of term. And I was full of grief, obviously, but trying to cover that up. My mother had insisted that I go to college as planned and that I didn't stay at home.
You've since written incredibly honestly about some of the feelings that you had back then, and you've said the feelings you had towards your father were, how dare you steal our happiness? Mm. You lied when you said you'd always be there for me.
Yes.
Very strong things to write down.
Well, I think initially there was anger, obviously. Well, there was a huge sadness and anger. I don't have that anger anymore at all because I now understand more of the kind of altered state he would be in with such massive depressions that he'd lived with ever since he was a young man. I did not know until much later that his first attempt on his life was when he was 16. And in fact, all credit to him and to my mum, that when it did eventually happen, my brother and I were so shocked by it because we had no idea that he lived like that.
And how, when he was having a difficult time and finding himself to be depressed, what was your mother saying about it? How was it coped? It must have been coped with somehow.
It was. I have memories of my dad taking to his bed with migraines. Well, I believe he did actually have migraines, but I think there was a lot else going on. And in fact, I looked at some diaries recently and found that my mum had asked for me to come home from school, bear in mind I was at a boarding school, just to be with my dad because he had a cold. And I realised that I was there for a week, probably being a bit of a guardian, a keeper, without me ever knowing that's what my job was.
So do you think that your mother always lived with the constant fear that this week might be the week when your father... Right.
I think when he was happy, he was extremely happy. So I think they had great big long spells of time where there wasn't a question about it, where they sailed... in fair weather, definitely.
How did the family repair then? What, you know, when something, I mean, you were very, very close to your dad, and obviously he was central to your life. When he wasn't there, how did the family structure readjust itself?
Well, interestingly, we were a square and we became a triangle. That's it. The sides join up and you're still strong.
And your mother then must have been an incredibly strong person.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, she always has been a strong person. You know, she was a survivor and a coper, and she wouldn't let anybody tell her that there was anything she couldn't do, including recover from that dreadful tragedy.
So tell me about this next piece of music then.
This piece of music is by Etta James, and it's At Last. And strangely, and typically, where my mum was very poorly and knew she was dying, she said to me, well, it's win-win, isn't it? And I said, how on earth can you say that, mum? You've got terminal lung cancer. And she said, well, either I stay here longer with you or I go and see your dad. And she absolutely believed that's what she'd do. So we played this at her funeral. Because at last she was with him.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over.
That was Etta James, and At Last, chosen by you, Dawn French, because it was played recently at your mother's funeral.
Yes.
According to Jennifer Saunders, when she first noticed you in college, you were wearing a corduroy skirt. What do you remember about her?
Yes, it was an A-line corduroy skirt. That's a further offence. I remember that she was very cool, very sophisticated, quite posh, I thought, and very beautiful. And I think she was sort of out of my league. And she was a little bit lofty. So I just decided that she wouldn't be one of the people that I would get to know. And then we had to share a flat. And that's when I realised that she was so many other things.
I wish I'd been in those classes where you had to sort of wrap yourself up in cling film or whatever it was and pretend to be a so-and-so. Were the two of you just perpetually mucking about?
It was absurd. The one you're referring to was actually a day when we entered a studio and the whole class were asked to wrap themselves in newspaper with sellotape. We had to help each other. That was part of it. Then the lights were lowered and we had to be reborn out of our eggs and have no language and learn how to communicate with each other. Well, honestly, from the very start, this was just silly. I couldn't enter into it at all. I did stay in my egg for a very long time because I knew that the minute I came out of it, I'd be out of control with laughter, especially if I caught Jennifer's eye, which I did. And we were asked to leave the class because we were ruining it for everybody else.
So much of your comedy, whether it's you dressing up as the ballerina or the two fat men, was based on your physical size. That was a very funny thing and you played up to that.
Yes.
You're much, much slimmer now. Did you worry that you wouldn't have the same ability to explore those comedy moments in that way?
No, I mean, I think if you've got comedy chops, you've got it whatever size you are, to be honest. But however, if you've got the gift of a bit of extra heft, use it, I would say. And also, there's something about me controlling what people will laugh at when it comes to my physical shape. I think I'd like to decide what you find funny about my fatness, if you like.
Yes.
So for me, there's a dignity in that. And there's, again, the mischief and the joy in that. I don't need you to be laughing at the fatness of me in a cruel or bullying way. And luckily in my life, I've never experienced that. But I know other big women do. And I don't like that at all. So I think that I've always wrestled that control into my domain.
You've always been a very gorgeous woman, fat or thin, very sexy person. You did it's characterised as a nude photo shoot. It wasn't really nude. You had this very artfully draped bed sheet around you.
Did.
It was very, very sexy for Esquire magazine. Why did you do that?
Well, I did it because I was doing a South Bank show about the aesthetics of fat. And I wanted lots of other big women to come and show us how great you can look with great lighting, with confidence, with great makeup, with great clothes. And of course, nobody would do it. This is how damaged we are. So I had to put my money where my mouth was. And I thought, OK, I'll have a big gin and tonic and I'll get my kit off. I did not expect the photo to be scanned in the sun with a poll for people to ring in and say whether you'd like to do it with me or not, or whether it's sexy or not.
What was the poll result? I bet it was a resounding yes.
I didn't want to look.
We got to fit in the music. Your sixth choice, what is it?
This is Patrick McNee and Honor Blackman singing Kinky Boots, and this is all about Jennifer and me. And we have had this song on our warm-up tape for every show we ever did, so I do get a little bit nervous listening to it because I think I'm due on stage.
Everybody's going for those kinky boots, kinky boots.
Kinky boots, it's a manly kind of fashion that you borrowed from the brutes.
Borrowed from the brutes. Kinky boots, fashion magazines say wear 'em.
And you rush to obey like the women in a harem.
Full length, half length.
Fully fashioned calf length.
Brown boots, black boots.
Patent leather jack boots.
Low boots, high boots.
Lovely lanky thigh boots.
We all dig those boots.
Patrick McNee and Honor Blackman and Kinky Boots. We both really enjoyed that, Dawn French. Now, you and Lenny Henry were Britain's sort of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, really.
Were we?
Yes, you were. I think you were the nation's sweetheart. People thought, we really like that.
Yes.
And we like that it's happened. Well, we like that they are doing
it. I'm glad they liked it because it was great.
That's quite a pressure, isn't it? And it's certainly quite a pressure once after 25 years you decide to be a part.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why people invested in it a bit is, you know, a black man, a white woman, and lots of racism came hurling at us. And we tried not to be too bothered about that. But he lived, and probably still lives, with a certain amount of that at all times. And I've got a mixed race daughter who also lives with a certain amount of it at all times. And it's shocking.
Was it, well, here's the thing. I was going to say, was it thrilling or terrifying? And maybe it was a bit of both, to be single in your early 50s.
It has been remarkable. Obviously, you don't get divorced without a deal of sadness. But we ended it and gave birth to the next chapter in our lives the right way. It was a tribute to the way we'd been married, the way we ended it.
That's a fantastically difficult thing to do. How did you accomplish that?
Kindness. That's all I can say. We knew that the marriage was untenable, and we were sad about that. And so we hunkered down, and we went home to Cornwall, and we walked on a beach and we drank a lot and we talked a lot. We laughed a lot, oddly. So those last few months of our relationship were pretty much like the first few months. We were good friends who decided to take a care about how we did this. Plus, we have a daughter who we both love very much. So we wanted this next chapter to be grown up. And I knew within 6 months of the final kind of separation that I was much lighter as a result of it. And I kind of started to claim my life back. And I thought, oh, God, what happens now? Do I do dating? How repulsive. I'll have to buy new pants. And I did do some dating and it was excruciating and difficult. I'm not an accomplished flirter. I'm quite direct. I think that is my form of flirting. Is I will give somebody an application form and say, tick these boxes. Do you want to see out summer pants, in summer pants? Out summer bra, in summer bra. Upstairs, downstairs. I'd rather get it all on the table and then get on with the fun. And that's not very romantic, is it?
No, it's not.
And then I had a glorious day when I was walking my dog, and it was a particularly beautiful day, and I live in Cornwall by the sea, and that made it extra shiny. And I thought, oh, look at this lovely day. Look at this lovely dog. Oh, look at my lovely life. Oh, my goodness. My daughter is happy. Len is happy. My mum at that point was still well. Everything's a bit great. And I've got the work that I want to do more than anything else. I'm writing here in Cornwall. And actually, I don't need a bloke. I don't need a bloke to be happy. I don't need to vicariously live through anybody else to feel strong and to feel any kind of proper joy. I feel joyful now. And I knew it, and it was like a big epiphany for me. And of course then, bang, I met somebody else. But I honestly don't believe that I would have been in the right frame of mind to meet him if I hadn't gone through that process.
And on that note, I want to ask you then about this next choice. Tell me about this.
Well, this is the Cocteau Twins as I know them, but it's in fact Liz Fraser singing with this mortal coil, the song To the Siren. And I didn't know much about Liz Fraser until my new chap, Mark, brought this song to me. And I knew when I heard the song. It was an offer, if you like.
On the floating ship's oceans, I did all my best to smile to your singing eyes and fingers drew me laughing to your eyes.
That was the Cocteau Twins' This Mortal Coil, yeah. Song to the Siren.
Yeah, you would fall in love, wouldn't you, with
you
somebody who gave you that song?
So your life in Cornwall now is what? Walks on the beach and love and happiness and writing.
Everything, it is, and cooking and, yeah, writing. I come up to London every now and again to do jobs that I want to do, but my life is there with him.
So it's a life together, is it?
I think so, yeah. Right. I think so. I hope so.
You once wrote that your dad's faith in you whilst he was alive had been, and I'm quoting now, such a sunshiny warmth that I grew towards it like a tomato plant. What a great phrase. But of course, like, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. How is your self-esteem now? Is it intact?
It is entirely intact, actually. And I think the reason it is because I have made sure that it is. I know that I will make a good life for myself with all sorts of things as my armour, stuff my dad taught me, stuff my mum taught me, stuff my brother's still teaching me, and stuff my new chap is teaching me that I never knew. A whole other set of stuff that I'm going forward with.
What sort of mother are you? You adopted your daughter when she was just 3 weeks old.
Have
you have you taken to the whole thing very easily? Because sometimes I read interviews with you and I think, oof, it sounds like sometimes that's been a bit of a struggle.
It certainly has. She is an amazing person who has taught me more than anybody else I know, because she's confounded everything I thought about parenthood. Everything I thought I could do well, I do pants, and things I didn't know I could do, I suddenly can do. All I know about it is that I love that kid enormously, which is good, because sometimes we don't like each other very much and we have wars that I think mothers and daughters are supposed to have. My theory about this is that if you don't rub up against each other a little bit, the tearing apart when it comes, when they have to move on, would be unbearable. But I am connected to that kid in the most constant and solid way. And I thank God for that, because it's a massive, profound blessing in my life.
I'm afraid to say we're at the last record. I feel I could do another
hour
of this. How can it be? Anyway,
we've only been here 2 minutes.
Tell me about your final choice, Dawn.
This is Elbow, One Day Like This, which is a massive, wonderful, joyful anthem. And I used to walk every morning to this song, and it lifted my heart. And it's also one of those songs in my life that I'm a bit disappointed other people know about it. I thought I owned this song. This is Elbow singing for me, for my future.
That was Elbow in One Day Like This. It's time for the books, Dawn. I'm going to give you the Bible and the Complete Works of Shakespeare.
I'm glad to have those too.
Right. What else would you like to take?
I would like to take Pacoon by Spike Milligan, because it's absolutely hilarious. And this book was read to me by my first boyfriend, and it is ludicrous and funny, and the genius of Spike Milligan just rings through it.
Right. Those are your books then. And your luxury.
I've decided that I will take my daughter's teddy, who is called Nobby. I will take that teddy because she won't be happy about it, but it smells of her, and I think it would be a really great pillow.
Win-win.
Yeah.
One of the eight. If you had to save just one, which one would it be?
I think it would be the Cocteau Twins.
Oh, Dawn French, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.